Luke chapter 22. There's a new handout in the back if you didn't get one for this evening. Luke 22. This is preparing for the passion of Jesus. Jesus has already entered, as we talked about the last time, entered Jerusalem. And now we come to the plot to kill Jesus, the Passover, and beyond. Here in chapter 22, verses 1 through 6, we find, "Now the festival of unleavened bread, which is called the Passover, was near. The chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to put Jesus to death, for they were afraid of the people. Then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who was one of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers of the temple guard about how he might betray him to them. They were greatly pleased and agreed to give him money, so he consented and began to look for an opportunity to betray him to them when no crowd was present." The Feast of Unleavened Bread is actually, if you go back to Exodus, that's the seven-day festival of which Passover is a part. And actually, the Passover meal is the first night. After the lambs are slaughtered, the Passover meal is the first night, and then you have the rest of the week that you do other things. But the climax really begins the festival as you move forward. Estimates and based on written documents say probably more than 100,000 pilgrims in Jerusalem for Passover back in Jesus' day. It's a very, very large crowd. And while obviously Jesus did not have the favor of 100,000 people, there were large enough crowds that did follow him and large enough crowds that were against him from the chief priests and others that it could cause pretty good riot. And the chief priests are afraid that if those riots start and they get out of hand, then the Roman officials will come in and not only will squash the riot, but if the chief priests are involved in it, then they're in big trouble. And they're worried about their particular jobs. But they're still worried about how do we eliminate Jesus? How do we get rid of him? We've got to do something, especially after he challenged them in the temple area when he entered Jerusalem. Now, Josephus indicates that the two designations, unleavened bread and Passover, basically were interchangeable by this time. People would talk about Passover and they didn't the Passover festival, and they didn't just mean the one day of Passover, they meant the whole seven-day festival. Or they'd say the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they would use that sometimes to talk about the Passover meal. So when Luke uses this here, it's just kind of interchangeable, and he is writing predominantly from a Gentile understanding, not fully aware of differences here. Now the chief priests and the scribes come from the Sanhedrin Council, and they find Judas and get assistance from him, Luke says, because the Satan entered him. It's interesting to note, as I note here, this is the first time that Satan has been mentioned in the Gospel of Luke since the temptations in chapter 4. The first time he's been mentioned. The first time the Satan is mentioned in the Gospel of Luke, he's trying to tempt Jesus and keep Jesus from accomplishing his task. The next time that he is specifically mentioned in the Gospel of Luke is here as he tries to influence, or he influences Judas Iscariot once again to try and stop Jesus from completing his mission. So here at the beginning of Jesus' ministry and at the end of toward the end of Jesus' ministry, the Satan is trying to undo what he's come to do. It's also interesting to note that Luke says that Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, he designates him as such, indicating that really from this point on, Judas's place is going to be vacant, and they're going to have to replace him. And of course, in the book of Acts at the beginning, in chapter 1, Peter says, "Now we need to replace Judas." But it's not, in Luke's understanding, in Luke's opinion, Judas' place is not empty when he kills himself. Judas' place becomes empty when he makes that decision to cooperate. And there are all kinds of reasons given as to why Judas might have done it. Some think that he was a zealot. who was disillusioned. He thought he had found the political earthly Messiah. He was disillusioned now because Jesus says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to play that role. I'm going to go suffer and die. My kingdom's not of this world. And so he decided, well, by golly, I'm going to get you back. Some think that he thought Jesus, yes, Jesus is that Messiah, and he's kind of wimping out here. He's afraid, so I'm going to put him in a position where he has to act and show his miracles, and then the Sanhedrin will follow him. I don't think it was because of the 30 pieces of silver, because he tried to give that money back and buy Jesus back, and that was the price of a common slave. But what I think Luke is indicating here is that Judas succumbed to temptation, whether it's the temptation of money or whether it's the temptation of anger and disillusionment or whether it's the temptation of trying to force Jesus to be what he wanted Jesus to be rather than letting Jesus be who he came to be. The point that Luke is making here is Judas succumbed to temptation. He gave in to temptation, and therefore it was sin. Of course, Simon Peter gives in to temptation too when he denies Jesus because he has an opportunity to stand up or not. But here Judas does this, and he has become part of those powers that are hostile to Jesus. That's why he sees this position as empty. So Judas meets with the chief priests and the captains of the temple guard. Albert Schweitzer, yes, the Albert Schweitzer, who actually had a degree in theology as well, wrote a book on the search for the historical Jesus. And in that he said, what Judas has actually done here is to betray the messianic secret, thus giving Jesus' enemies a basis for charging him with treason. That part of his messiahship was kept secret to the point that until the crucifixion resurrection happened, they wouldn't understand his messiahship. And that what Judas did was turned around and went to the chief priests and the scribes and said, well, he's claiming to be Messiah. So therefore they could arrest him, they could ask him these questions, and if he agreed with it, then we can take him up to the Romans, the charge of treason or sedition, trying to start a riot, trying to become a king. So he looks for an opportunity to betray Jesus when no crowds would be around, and he actually knows he will find out soon when that opportunity will be. When Jesus prepares for the Passover, Judas knows what's going to happen afterwards. Because we'll find that as was Jesus' custom, when in Jerusalem, he would go, especially at Passover, he would go to the Mount of Olives where the Garden of Gethsemane is located afterwards, and that's where he would go to pray in the night. So we come to chapter 22, verses 7 and following. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Luke once again is interchanging unleavened bread and Passover. Unleavened bread and Passover. But this is a Passover meal. The Synoptic Gospels, that's Mark, Matthew, and Luke, claim that it is a Passover meal. The Gospel of John says it was before the Passover, the day before the Passover, which would have been a little bit strange. The New Testament theologian Joachim Jeremias claims that Jesus celebrated this as a Passover meal, but he did it the night before it was supposed to be done because he knew he was going to be crucified the next day at noon when the Passover lambs were slaughtered. Sorry, I disagree with him, but he was a major New Testament theologian last century. And there are some things I agree with him on. This one I don't in particular. Although Jeremias also goes on, as do some other scholars, to say that when you look at, in 1 Corinthians in particular, when you look at Paul talking about that Last Supper, he doesn't say it's Passover meal. He just said they gathered to eat the meal. And so that's part of the reason why Jeremias says that since Paul recognized it not as a Passover meal or didn't call it such, that's one of the reasons why Jeremias, among others, says that Jesus celebrated the meal before the Passover, as John says, rather than on the night of Passover as Mark, Matthew, and Luke. But Jesus does something rather unusual. But given the tenor of the time and the fact of potential for riots, usually the leader of the group is the one that would prepare for special feasts. But Jesus sends Peter and John into the city because he knows that if he enters the town, immediately people are going to start saying, well, there's Jesus, there's Jesus, there's Jesus, and there's no way he can unobtrusively find a place or go to a place and set up for the meal, because there'll be crowds following him, not just the disciples, and there will be, very possibly, the word will spread to the chief priests and they'll come after him as well. So he sends Peter and John, who, while they are known, are not considered as dangerous as Jesus is by the authorities. Now, in this story, if you read it, and you wonder how I'm going to get through the chapter by not reading everything, if you read it, you know that Jesus tells them to go into the city and to look for a man carrying a jar of water, which was women's work. It's highly unlikely the man would be carrying it unless it was a prearranged signal. So the many scholars who contend that the man carrying the jar of water was a prearranged signal. He was probably a follower who lived in Jerusalem, someone who had come to believe in Jesus and had already prepared the room in the house for them. And so they go and they find him, follow him into the house. And they go and they find the man, and the place is already furnished. That means the cushions and the low tables. We've said before that Da Vinci's Last Supper is a little bit misleading. Actually, a lot misleading. Because they didn't sit around tables in straight back chairs or even on stools. Passover meal was to be eaten reclining. To remind you, if you go back and read in Exodus, to remind them that God called them out of their beds in the middle of the night. And so they would eat reclining, and they would either lean on cushions with a low table, or they'd lean on the cushion and there'd be a mat on the floor and the food would be placed there, and they would reach out and eat the food that way. By the way, if you haven't noticed if you've been in my office and haven't noticed the elephant in the room, that is the big framed picture hanging behind the couch. Sometime when you're in there, take a look at it. That was one of my Christmas presents from Steve and Lynn, and they said Sydney helped with a few pieces. It's a 2,500-piece puzzle that they glued, put together, and framed of the Last Supper. And then they thought they could just do that and go out and buy a frame. No, it was custom frames. But it's very, very nice. But they didn't sit in those chairs. They reclined. And so this man would have had the place ready with cushions and a low table. In fact, literally, as I say here, when you read the text and it says, and they sat at table, the word that is used there also means to recline, back. Doesn't necessarily mean you're sitting straight up. You can recline back on an elbow. So they would have been doing that. And Jesus uses this occasion, starting in verse 14, Jesus uses this occasion to teach the disciples, to teach them about his sacrifice, what is taking place. While we know that Luke used Mark some, he had other sources, we know that. And obviously here he had a different source than Mark and Matthew, because in Mark and Matthew, and as we do it, and I've often thought about changing it, and then I figured now somebody would probably throw something at me and say that. But in Matthew and Mark, the bread is given first and then the cup. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 and following, the bread and then the cup. But in Luke, the cup, the wine, is served before the bread. It's probably from Luke's separate source. And actually, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 16, the wine is mentioned as being taken before the bread. So what this shows is there was not, even in the early church and in the early church's remembrance, there was not necessarily a set formula yet as to whether you did the bread first or the wine first, and what was said and what wasn't, and that kind of thing. But here at this Passover meal, because I do think that it was, we find Jesus celebrating this Passover meal, and it links the church and it links the disciples to the new Israel of God. Verse 15 here, he said to them, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Serves a twofold purpose. The meal, this meal, is the only thing between Jesus and his suffering. He knows once this meal is over, he's going to be arrested and he's going to suffer. Also, this meal is being identified with the Messianic banquet in the coming kingdom. That is, where God's children will be fellowshipping with God in the coming kingdom. Moving over into verse 16, "For I tell you, I will not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." And that actually means I will not eat it again until it's fulfilled in the kingdom of God. He says, I'm not going to have another Passover with you. I'm not going to have another meal like this. And it's a sign to them that he is going to suffer and he's going to die. He's not going to have an opportunity to share the Passover with them once again. But it reminds them that there is going to be a messianic banquet for those who are close followers of God. Now, the drinking of the cup indicates both fellowship with Jesus and expectation, because drinking a cup sometimes was associated with suffering or persecution or doing a particular action. The drinking of the cup here not only reminds them of fellowship with Jesus, but it also reminds them that they can expect to drink the same cup of suffering that Jesus has drunk. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be crucified. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be beaten with a cat of nine tails or a scourge. But what it does mean is that they can anticipate and expect persecution, expect times where they will suffer because they've drunk the cup with Jesus and followed him. Then they also drink of the cup of suffering as a potential. And he's using that to teach them this. I'm going to suffer, but here, drink the cup. If you drink this cup, you are also going to suffer as well. As they partake of the one loaf, it's not like all the little crackers in the plate, but as they partake of the one loaf, it says that they're part of the oneness of the new community of God. In fact, the blood of the covenant is, in some translations, there's the blood of the covenant phrase that's added, in some it's left out. In some of the ancient Greek manuscripts, it's there, and in some of them, it's not. When it speaks of the blood, this is of the drink, this is the blood of my covenant, of the new covenant. It really is meaning that there is a new Israel. There's a new Exodus. It links them with the original Passover, where God delivers his people. And so what it's doing is saying a new Exodus has occurred. In Jesus, they're leaving the old way of life, and a new way of life has begun. And that's what happened in the Exodus. They left behind that old way in slavery, and now they were free. For Christians, the Lord's Supper takes the place of the Jewish Passover, and it sets them free. It is the blood of the new covenant. There was the old covenant. Now there's a new covenant made with the Christian church, the people of God that follow Jesus. And so this represents that just as much as if you go back and read in Exodus 11 and 12, if you go back and read there about that early Passover and coming out of Egypt, there were cups of wine there that represented the promises of God made through the blood of the sacrifice. Same thing here. The wine that is drunk connects them to those promises and even beyond, and says this is the new covenant that you have. As he's doing that, in verse 21, "But see, the one who betrays me is with me, and his hand is on the table, for the Son of Man is going as it has been determined. But woe to that one by whom he is betrayed." Mark's wording is different. Luke says here, "as it has been determined." There is the expectation that both Jesus' death has already been decided. That's the way to salvation. And that he will be betrayed to send him to that death has already been decided. And it seeks to strengthen the fact, I mean, it doesn't reduce Judas's responsibility, but it seeks to strengthen the fact that Jesus' death is a divine necessity. It's something that God sees as necessary to complete that redemption. And so when he says here, as it has been determined, what Luke is saying is God has decided that the means by which people will be redeemed is through sacrifice, and the sacrifice of Jesus, his son. And that the fact that he is betrayed is the means that God decided was necessary to get him to that point where this can happen. The only way it can stop now is if God in Jesus stops it. If Jesus in the garden decides not to go through with it, that's the only way it can be stopped. Doesn't mean I've predetermined it and Jesus doesn't have a choice. Because if Jesus didn't have a choice, then that agony in the garden is not really agony. It's a facade. But God says, I've determined this is the way it needs to happen. And now Jesus in the garden, as a human, suffering for us, facing death, as we said this morning, Jesus has to make that decision to follow with the plan that God determined or decided he wanted to do, or not. That's the only thing that can railroad, can stop this, is Jesus' decision. So then they start arguing. The disciples start arguing about which one would be greatest, and nobody would do this if they were really great. They began to ask which one of them it could be who would dare do such a thing, and in the middle of that, it might be him. No, it's not me, but it might be you. You know, they start arguing back and forth, pointing fingers, because they don't want to look at themselves. Even Simon Peter, he was probably one of the loudest ones in that bunch, because later on when Jesus says, you're going to betray me, he stands up to Jesus toe-to-toe, face-to-face, and said, ain't going to happen. And Jesus said, oh, ho, ho, you're going to eat those words, and they're not going to taste very good. So they start arguing, who would do such a thing? Whoever's great would stand against anybody that even tried to do that. And Jesus says, you know, y'all are acting like the rest of the world. You're acting like even the pagans do. You're not acting like people in God's kingdom. You're acting like a culture of children. They're arguing. He said, listen here. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. That is, their position and their power. And those in authority over them are called benefactors. They're benefactors. But, he says, whoever in the kingdom of God, whoever would be greatest must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves. The youngest in the family. How many in here are the baby? Although I think most of y'all probably got privilege instead of the rest of us. Back then, I'm the oldest, you know. We know that my youngest brother got, well, my sister and then my youngest brother. But the youngest in the family back then got all the menial tasks. Carry out the garbage. Go clean up after the sheep in the courtyard. Wash people's feet. You know, if you didn't have servants, that's what the youngest had to do. The menial tasks were the smallest reward, the ones that people overlooked. But Jesus says, while the normal situation in society is that the man who sits at the table and has authority is greater than the one who serves, in my kingdom, the greatest is the one who gives self humbly to serve others. And it's even greater if it's one who could have authority, but that person chooses to serve. Luke emphasizes then the divine necessity of Jesus coming, Jesus serving, and Jesus' death. I am among you as one who serves. The end of verse 27. If anybody could have claimed out of this group to be served, it would be Jesus, right? Son of God on earth. But instead, Jesus says, I could have this privilege, but I'm not. I'm here to serve you. Implication, if you truly follow me, then you're here to serve somebody else. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you, just as my Father has conferred on me, a kingdom. Said, you're going to be part of the kingdom. So that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you'll sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. He said, you'll have your place, but only if you serve. He said, I'm giving you the same kind of kingdom I've got. But how does he get to that kingdom? Through serving. Through serving. He says, you can come to that kingdom too, but you've got to serve. Then he turns and looks to Simon Peter, because he knows that Simon's going to have to do some things for the folks. And he says, Simon, Simon, listen. Satan has demanded to sift all of you like wheat. To sift you, plural. All of you. In other words, he's saying every one of you is going to be tested. To sift is a euphemism which means to test and tempt. And every disciple will be put to the test in life. Jesus says, but I have prayed for you that your own faith may not fail. And you, when once you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. Interesting, you is singular there. He's speaking to Simon Peter, and he said, all of you are going to be tested. The devil wants to test every one of you and wants to sift you like wheat, the good and the bad. He said, but Peter, I prayed for you specifically because you're going to have to help your brothers, your brethren and your sister. You're going to have to help these others when they face temptation. And he says, my prayers and my intervention are in opposition to Satan wanting to sift you. Now, which one's stronger? You decide. God will not abandon us in times of need and weakness. We are to strengthen the faith of others because we're family. We're all God's children through Jesus, in Jesus, with Jesus, and are to strengthen each other. When he mentions the faith here, it's faith that is the kind of commitment to Christ in which we will acknowledge him publicly, even if it's going to cost us. Even if it's going to cost us. That's the faith he's talking about here. Is the faith that your own faith may not fail. The faith to stand up and to tell people. That doesn't mean in your face kind of stuff, but to let them know that we're Christians, even if it's going to cost us. And Peter stands up, probably beats himself on the chest and says, ha, Lord, I'm ready to go with you. Let's go get them. Let's run out of the tunnel out onto the field. We're going to whoop them. That's my homage to the Super Bowl tonight. But I'm with you all the way. Jesus just shook his head and said, this day you'll deny me even before the third watch of the night. I tell you, the cock will not crow this day until you have denied three times that you know me. The rooster, according to the Romans, there were three watches in the night. And the rooster crowed at the third watch, shortly before daybreak. Peter didn't believe him. Jesus said, you'll deny you even knew me. But what's really interesting is he's already told Peter, I pray that your faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned back, strengthen your brother. He's telling you, he knows, Peter, you're gonna be out here and you're going to protest and you're going to say, oh no, I won't deny you, but it's going to happen. But just remember, when you come back, you need to show to your brothers and sisters the same strength that it takes for you to get back. You need to help them. In verses 35 to 38, he said, "When I sent you out without a purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "No, not one thing." He said, "Now the one who has a purse must take it, and likewise a bag, and the one who has no sword must sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you, this scripture must be fulfilled in me." And he was counted among the lawless. "And indeed, what is written about me is being fulfilled." And they said, "Lord, look, here we got two swords already." And he said, "It's enough." It's a reference back to when he sent them out with the 70 earlier. And he said, "Did you need anything?" "No, you told us not to take anything." "We didn't need anything. We were accepted." He said, "Well, times are different now. You're not going to be accepted so readily. You may even be persecuted and hated. You need to be prepared for hostility. Hostility to the gospel. Hostility to you." So that's the reference to buying swords. And they tell Jesus, "Oh, we got two swords already." And he says, "Enough talk about swords. Let's move on." When he says here about sell his cloak, interestingly enough, the cloak was the outer garment that served like a coat. And when you were traveling around, you didn't have a horse. You didn't have that saddle. If you were a cowboy and you travel around, you had that horse and you had that saddle, what did you have on the back of the saddle so when it came nighttime you could lay down and go to sleep? A blanket, a bedroll. About what you did then. If you were traveling, you had a cloak. If it got to be nighttime, you were out in the hillside or you were somewhere else, didn't have a place to sleep, you took that coat off and you laid it on the ground and that's what you slept on. So I said, you're going to have to, people are going to be hostile to you and you're going to have to fend for yourself and take care of yourself. And what you thought was so good and precious before is going to be a necessity for you. Then the text says, he came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. And when he reached the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not come into the time of trial or temptation." And he went away a stone's throw. Luke kind of shortens the story here. We only have one long prayer session instead of three short prayer sessions that Mark and Matthew give us. But Luke's already been wordy enough in this chapter. He needs to hustle up so we can get finished. But when he says, as was his custom, it's an indication that, and Jesus will later say, when the chief priest come to arrest him, he said, "Look, I preached out in the open. You didn't do anything to me then. How come you're coming here at night? Like I'm a thief or a robber." It's Luke's way also of saying to the Gentile readers that Jesus wasn't being politically subversive. It was his custom. He wasn't being overly secretive about his movement here. People knew. That's also how Judas knew to tell him to go get him, because he knew where he would be after this. And he says when they got to the place, one of the other things interesting about Luke is he rarely mentions Semitic names, that is, Jewish names of places. He'll either give you a Gentile region, a Greek area, or he'll say something like here, when they go to the Mount of Olives, well, we knew Gethsemane was there, but they go to the Mount of Olives when they got to the place, which is Gethsemane, the olive grove. When they got to the place, then he went in and did that. But remember also to whom he's writing. He's not writing to Jews, Semites. He's writing to Gentiles to show them in part that Jesus didn't just come for the Jews. Jesus is here for Gentiles as well. So he's not writing a Semitic kind of thing. Jesus being a stone's throw away, as he says, means that he's close enough to where the disciples can still hear him and can still see the struggle he's going through if they'll pay attention. But they've had a big meal. They've had a few glasses of wine. It's late, almost midnight, and you know what happens. I bet there were at least one or two people in here this afternoon after eating two or three helpings of everything that was on the table that probably had a hard time not reading inside their eyelids this afternoon, right? And they've eaten a meal. They've had a few glasses of wine, and here they go, and Jesus says, "Pray." Well, they shut their eyes to pray, And they probably did like a lot of people do when they go, if they lay down in the bed to say their evening prayer. Might get about two or three lines into it, and the next thing God hears is, they're over there, but they go to sleep. However, Jesus in his prayer still voices that trusting relationship of Father and Son. He does plead, though, that there's another way. He's not only faces death, he's faced rejection from even friends of his. Not just the religious leaders. He's faced rejection from friends. People to whom he came, for whom he came, to whom he offered love and care and friendship and redemption, and they've rejected him. And he does agonize over this. In fact, verses 43 and 44, while they're not in some manuscripts, do give us an idea. Then an angel from heaven appeared to him and gave him strength. In his anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down on the ground. He has prayed if there's any other way, but the ultimate decision he makes is, even though he'd like not to have to go through this in his humanity, he decides, God, this is what you want done, therefore this is what I'm going to do. The mention of the angel reminds readers that just as God did not abandon Jesus here, God through Jesus will not abandon those who follow faithfully, even to the point of death. This will be something that will stimulate folks who are facing martyrdom to continue to stand firm rather than recant their testimony and their belief. Knowing that just as Jesus went through the anxiety and the fear, because I guarantee you that most of those folks that were martyred were still scared. They didn't really want to die. But they had that assurance that just as God was with Jesus in all of this, God would not abandon them either. And even though they might die physically, they would find themselves in God's presence and at the Messianic banquet. Jesus comes and finds the disciples sleeping. I put because of sorrow, because one commentator that I read a while back said, well, they fell asleep because they were just so sorrowful they couldn't stand to stay awake. I don't know about y'all, but if I'm really sorrowful about something, I have a harder time sleeping. And he repeats that injunction. They pray to avoid succumbing to temptation. That is, succumbing to the hostility that they will experience, the anguish they will feel, the pressure that they will feel to recant, because if they do so, it's a sin to give in to those pressures, to give in to that hostility. They commit sin. Judas and the guys show up about that time. And actually, my translation, but Jesus said to him, Judas, is it with a kiss that you are betraying the Son of Man? Actually, in the Greek text, with a kiss is the first thing you run into. The phrase says, with a kiss, Judas, you'd betray the Son of Man? It's emphatic that here you have been one of mine, I have shown you love and grace, and you betray me with the utmost sign of faithfulness and loyalty and love for your rabbi. Not to be lost on Judas, the impact of that. He says, with a kiss? It's almost like, I'd rather you come and knock me down, but with a kiss? As he kisses him on the cheek. And then he confronts him, says, yeah, what? Who am I? You know? Of course, I did skip over somebody. We presume it was Simon Peter because he tended to be hot-headed. Could have been somebody else took one of those swords and cut the ear off the servant of the high priest. Luke is the only one, but then again, he's a doctor. Luke's the only one that says Jesus heals it. Everybody else leaves the ear on the ground and the guy screaming. But Luke says that he healed it, and it's enough of this. Put away his swords. Enough of this. He says, listen, when I was with you day after day in the temple, you didn't lay hands on me. But now you come like I'm a robber, an insurrectionist. This is your hour and the power of darkness. Jesus is saying, by using the darkness and the hour here, Luke is saying that what Jesus is indicating is, yes, there is evil in the world. Yes, there is darkness in the world. But evil and darkness will only have the upper hand for a short time. Evil and the scope of evil and darkness is limited. Are limited. No, is limited. We quit an hour and the next five, we can go over 5 minutes and finish. I heard go. They seized him and led him away. They seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. Now, we don't know. Annas had been high priest, and his son-in-law Caiaphas was high priest at that particular point in time. Some ancient texts mention Annas. But it could be that he and Caiaphas lived at the same place. And Mr. Super Confident is put to the test. The only one that follows is Simon Peter, but he follows kind of in the darkness, in the shadows. Big bad Simon Peter says, I'll stand up, I'll never deny you. I'll die before I ever deny you. When Jesus said, oh, you're going to deny me three times before the third watch is over. And Peter said, no, ain't going to happen. It's not a Roman soldier. It's not Pontius Pilate. It's not even Caiaphas the high priest. But it's a little maiden girl. That says, wait a minute, hold on. You were with him. This man is one of his. This man was with him. And big bad Simon Peter, instead of standing up and saying, yeah, you're right, what are you going to do? Big bad Simon Peter denies. In fact, three times he denies, even knowing Jesus, much less following him. You're a Galilean. Man, I don't even know what you're talking about. The third time. At that moment, while he was still speaking, rooster crows. And interestingly enough, the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Now, we don't know if maybe he was being led here, or maybe if it was in the house that some people think was Caiaphas, they're meeting this small group. It had an upper chamber, and Jesus might have been by the window. But Luke says, about that time, Jesus turned and looked at him. And that's more than Peter can stand. He's overcome with grief and he runs away weeping. The priests and the temple guards mock him and beat him. The one who came to offer him grace and love, they beat. They made fun of him. That's the way they spent their time. Well, we really can't do a whole lot till daylight when Pilate gets up, so let's have some fun here. Some of them even blindfolding him and slapping him and say, okay, prophesy, tell us who did this. Give us a name, rank, and serial number. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, gathered together and brought him to their council, the full Sanhedrin here. This earlier one's a small meeting. And they said, if you're the Messiah, tell us. And he said, well, if I tell you, you won't believe, and if I question you, you won't answer, and some texts say, or release me. Jesus doesn't answer because he knows it's useless to defend himself. He already knows the mind's already been made up. Doesn't matter what he says. They won't make an honest decision. Are you the Messiah? Well, if he says that, if he says, yes, he is, they say, earthly political king, guess what? We can take you to Rome. Are you the Son of God? That's blasphemy, which wouldn't impress the Romans. But maybe they could parlay that into sedition or treason. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. And all of them asked, are you then the Son of God? All Jesus had to do was keep his mouth shut. He could have walked free. But he looked at them and said, "You say that I am." This is both assent and an accusation against them. He's giving assent to, "Yeah, I really am. You say that I am, and I really am." But he's also saying, "You're the guys that are using it to try and get rid of me. You're supposed to be on the side of God. You're standing against God." And then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." Interesting thing is, according to their rules and regulations, and I could go into my office, I've got a book that's got some of that in it. And according to the rules and regulations, no man before the Sanhedrin could be declared as guilty of worthy of death based solely on his admission of guilt. There had to be at least two witnesses to corroborate it. But they've already decided. Now all they've got to do is put together the charges to take Jesus before Pontius Pilate. Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God in history to the world. And in that revelation, there were those who sought to squash it and only reveal what they thought God meant in the world. And I went over 6 minutes, not five.
That has to be one of the greatest documents of human weakness, in my point of view.
Yeah, it is a human weakness.
I mean, how weak it can be. I mean, they walked with Jesus and denied it.
Yes.
But it's always a human mindset. It always happens to somebody else. It don't happen to us.
Oh, yeah. It'll always, Simon Peter said that. He said, "Oh, it won't be me. I won't do it. I'll die first." And then he didn't even have the chance to think about dying. That made, I mean, all he probably would have done was taken him, beat him up a little bit, shoved him around if he's, you know, and he'd get away and go the other way. But he was afraid even of that. And so he protected himself. He protected himself. Next week we'll look at chapter 23. Which includes the rest of the trials, the beating, etc. of Jesus. Hope you have a good night. Be careful. May God bless you in all that you do. Amen.